This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Mali remains firmly opposed to any military intervention by ECOWAS, which would have disastrous consequences for Niger, but for the whole of the region as well.
That's Mali's Foreign Minister, Abdoulaye Diop, who told world leaders at the UN General Assembly that his country would not stand idle by if neighboring Niger is attacked. Details coming up also. U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin is in Kenya today. And Eswatini heads towards elections. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Making his first trip to Africa as Defense Secretary, Lloyd Austin yesterday met Somali President Hassan Sheikh Mahmoud in Djibouti. Today he is in Kenya's capital, Nairobi, where our Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb is shadowing the Secretary and is standing by at VOA's Nairobi office to brief us. Welcome to Africa News Tonight, Carla.
Thanks for having me.
So first, the Somali president, Hassan Sheikh Mahmoud, met Secretary Austin. What was their discussion yesterday?
Well, they had a very frank discussion about the progress that Secretary Austin said is being made against the al-Shabaab militants there. It's a hard fight, Secretary Austin said, but he pointed out to reporters that the Somalis have made more progress against the terror group in the past year than they had in the past 5 years combined. And this meeting is happening as the Somali president is asking the African Union to extend their drawdown and delay their drawdown by 3 months because, as the Somali president says, there have been some major setbacks. And in order to keep the security situation stable, he says he wants to keep those African Union forces in Somalia a little longer. We asked the secretary about this today, and he basically said that the Somali president is just focused on maintaining all of the progress that has been made, and he doesn't want to see the security situation slip. And so he's doing what he feels will help keep that security situation moving forward instead of slipping backwards. Because if you look at the situation in Somalia, the Somalis have been very successful in pushing out the terror groups from the center of the country, but they are still able to make massive attacks. I mean, just over the last couple of days, we saw a truck bomb that killed more than 20 people. So there are still a lot of things that need to be done and a lot of security things that need to be done. But the Somalis are very focused on that, the secretary said.
So what happened in Nairobi today? He is in Kenya.
He is in Kenya. Somalia came up again because he thanked the Kenyans, his Kenyan counterpart, for the efforts that Kenya has made helping with Somali security. He also thanked the Kenyans for hosting American forces in Manda Bay. He will be visiting Manda Bay, the base in Kenya that holds U.S. troops tomorrow. And this is all part, in his eyes, he's trying to go to security partners with Djibouti, visiting them first, with Kenya now, that have a long-standing relationship with the United States. Take Kenya, for example. They have had a security cooperation since the 70s. This is the first time, by the way, that a Secretary of Defense from the United States has visited Kenya since 1976. So it's quite a big deal here in Nairobi to have the Secretary visit today.
So what's next for the Secretary after Kenya?
So after Kenya, the Secretary is going to visit Angola. Angola may be a little bit of a surprise because there has not been that strong long security cooperation with Angola like there has been in Djibouti or Kenya. But the U.S. says that they would like to change that. And the secretary told reporters that the Angolans, actually, his counterpart reached out to him and said that they would like to cooperate more with the United States. And that is why they want to go there, because they want to try to make strengthen the ties that they have and start working not just on a military-to-military cooperation, but also to help with economic development as well.
And lastly, Carl, French President Macron yesterday said France will remove its military from Niger by the end of the year. And as you know, the U.S. has an air base in Niamey, the capital of Niger. Any remarks from the secretary Niger, France withdrawing from Niger?
Yes, asked about Niger today, the secretary said that France definitely has the right to do whatever France wants when it comes to where its forces are across the globe. But he said that as for the United States made one change. They moved some forces out of the base in the capital, out to Agadez, which is about 1,000 kilometers away from the capital. But other than that, they are keeping the force numbers relatively the same. There are still about 1,000 American forces in Niger, and they have stopped doing counterterrorism operations in Niger right now with the Nigerian forces, and that is because they say they want to see a diplomatic solution. They want to make sure that the constitutionally elected government will be able to be in power. But the U.S. has still not officially called this a coup. And all the officials that I speak to keep referring to this as the attempted coup because they say that they're hoping that diplomacy will win at the end of the day. And there are a lot of U.S. forces there, and there's a lot of equipment. They spent millions of dollars building that base in Agadez, Air Base 201. It has a lot of drone capability, so they can do intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance flights, so they can look at these terror groups that are basically exploding in West Africa. And so this base is very, very important. And I was talking to analysts, and they say if they lose this base in West Africa, the next closest base that America really has to launch intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance missions is from Djibouti, which is all the way on the other side of the continent. So they are taking this step by step, day by day. And while France has made their decision to pull out, the United States has not made any decision of that sort.
Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb, shadowing Secretary Lloyd Austin in Nairobi. Thank you for your input.
You're welcome.
Voters in the small kingdom of Eswatini, formerly Swaziland, go to the polls this week, and we'll have a report on that coming up. But first, in his speech over the weekend to world leaders, Mali's top diplomat warned his country will not stand idle by if foreign powers intervene in Niger. VOA's Carol Van Damme has more.
Speaking through a translator, Foreign Minister Abdoulaye Diop said his country is staunchly opposed to any military intervention in neighboring Niger.
Mali remains firmly opposed to any military intervention by ECOWAS, which would have disastrous consequences for Niger, but for the whole of the region as well. Any military intervention in Niger or any aggression, any invasion of that country would pose a direct threat to the peace and security of Mali, but also to the peace and security of the region.
Diop, who was representing Mali's military junta, said any such move by the West African regional bloc ECOWAS would have consequences. He was speaking Saturday at the United Nations General Assembly in New York. ECOWAS has threatened military intervention if the democratically elected president, Mohamed Bazoum, is not reinstated. The military overthrew the president in late July. The regional bloc has repeatedly called for Bazoum and his family to be released from house arrest, and it has sent multiple delegations to Niamey in search of a peaceful solution. The coup made Niger the third country in the Sahel to be led by a military junta in a little over 2 years, following Burkina Faso and Mali. Last week, the military leaders of all three countries entered into a mutual defense pact to intervene if any one of the three are attacked. During his address at the General Assembly, Diop also criticized France for what he calls its neo-colonial domination, while praising Russia's growing influence in the volatile region.
I wish to recall that on the 15th of August 2022, the government of Mali had alerted the United Nations Security Council to hostile acts and aggressions by France. Rather than ceasing such actions, this country, a permanent member of the Security Council of the United Nations, continues with full impunity its destabilizing maneuvers in Mali and the Sahel.
Diop praised Russia for what he calls its active solidarity and reliable commitment, both bilaterally and multilaterally. Bamako also has pushed out the UN peacekeeping mission MINUSMA, which is scheduled to complete its withdrawal by the end of the year. Instability in the Sahel has increased international concern over the impoverished region, which faces growing Islamist insurgencies linked to Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State Group. Carol Van Dam for VOA News, Washington.
Voters in the small kingdom of Eswatini, formerly Swaziland, go to the polls this week in a tense atmosphere. Darren Taylor reports.
Political parties remain banned in Eswatini in spite of pro-democracy protests that have, at times, been met with violence from the king's security forces. People vote for leaders of tinkundlas, or tribal communities, who then go to parliament, making up a House of Assembly and a Senate. But the king himself selects some members and often appoints relatives to govern, especially in senior positions. There'll be more of the same when voters go to the polls on Friday, says the head of Good Governance Africa, Chris Maruleng.
The Tinkundla system is really characterized by the predominance of this absolute monarchy in the form of King Mswati. And governance in that country after the suspension of the constitution in 1973 by King Mswati's father, King Sobhuza II, has really seen the monarchy in and of itself ruling without the need to consult and indeed without reference to the legislature.
Maruleng says it's incumbent upon the government of South Africa, Eswatini's main economic partner, to exert a bit of pressure on King Mswati for democracy.
It is bizarre that in Eswatini, a country that we totally surround, that we have been unable to really influence the monarchy, not to relinquish its rights as a monarchy, but really to become a constitutional monarchy constrained by the rule of law and recognizing the rights of their subjects at law.
In June 2021, activists say Eswatini security forces opened fire on hundreds of people calling for political reform at a gathering in Mbabane, the capital. Almost 250 people were wounded and at least 80 died, making it one of the worst massacres in southern African history. The United Nations Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights found Eswatini security forces used live ammunition and engaged in disproportionate and unnecessary use of force. Eswatini government spokesperson Alpheus Nkomalo denies that the police and soldiers were responsible.
Why was that protest conducted during the night? Who was killing the people there? Did we have mercenaries that came into the country who actually murdered these particular people? Terrorists don't cross borders through border gates. They infiltrate countries. That's why their work is always carried out during the dark and during the night. There is no credibility whatsoever in the position to say government murdered, security forces murdered.
In January, unknown gunmen killed lawyer and pro-democracy activist Thulani Maseko inside his home about 30 miles from Mbabane. The killing happened a few hours after King Mswati issued a public warning to activists opposed to his rule. The government denied involvement in Maseko's death. Nkomalo insists Friday's vote will be free and fair. Outside observers describe all previous elections as lacking transparency and not conforming to democratic principles. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. A Kenyan lawmaker from the ruling United Democratic Alliance, or UDA, has suggested extending the presidential term limit from 5 to 7 years. Mohammed Yusuf reports.
Speaking to reporters at the parliamentary buildings, Samson Cherargei of the United Democratic Alliance, senator from the Rift Valley region, said the current 5-year mandate is not enough to run a government.
This enables the president to have a good opportunity to form and establish a formidable team to deliver his manifesto. Besides, the Kenya presidential election is always highly profile as a result of it being conducted within a short period of time, thus making it a do-or-die event. The continuous campaign mood in the currency has been occasioned by the perception that elections are held within the short period of 5 years. In any election period, we lose our own year in campaigns, and another year is lost immediately after election because of the litigations in the Supreme Court.
Kenya usually has very competitive politics during elections, which can lead to deadly protests, ethnic tensions and violence. In case of a presidential election dispute, the matter is taken to the country's Supreme Court, which takes less than a month to decide. The court judgment, if it favours the winner, gives him a week to be sworn in and a few weeks to create a cabinet, which is approved by Parliament. Kenya's political commentator Martin Andati says the plan is intended to divert voters' attention away from the real problems faced by the country.
I think they are creating diversionary tactics because they know that for you to be able to change the term limits, you have to go through a referendum. So I think they could basically be creating something to keep Kenyans busy as a diversionary tactic to get people concerned with that so that they move away from raising the pertinent issues. So there are issues. There are issues of the economy, there are issues of the government, of borrowing, all those issues. So to create a diversionary tactic, you come up with something that would now be attractive for people to talk about.
This month, Kenya experienced the highest fuel prices in its history, reaching 211 shillings per litre of petrol. This increase is expected to impact the prices of essential goods. The government blames the price increase on the global rise in oil prices. In a statement, Cleophas Malala, Secretary General of the ruling party, distanced the UDA from the ongoing debate on extending presidential terms. Malala said the president has sworn to respect, uphold and defend the constitution, which outlines the presidential term limit. Any changes to the constitution will require referendum. Cherargei argues that the constitution can be amended through a popular vote.
Let's meet in the pointers. Because our constitution envisages amendment of the constitution at any given time, so long as the threshold is met under the provisions of Article 256 and 257 through popular initiative.
The senator has submitted a proposal to the committee tasked with finding a political solution for the hotly contested 2022 elections. He anticipates that government and opposition members will adopt this proposal in future political conversations. Mohammed Yusuf, VA News, Nairobi.
The Moroccan government says it's budgeting almost $13 billion to help the country recover from the September 8th earthquake that killed nearly 3,000 people. It announced $11 billion would be used for reconstruction, rehousing, and socio-economic development of affected areas. It is also setting aside $11.7 billion to help 4.2 million affected people over a period of 5 years. Elizabeth Myers, an American political analyst living in Marrakesh, spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi about the series of Moroccan efforts taken since the quake hit 2 weeks ago.
The first things that happened pretty much were the king cut short a private trip and came back within hours of hearing about the earthquake and immediately ordered the army out to engage in search and rescue efforts. So those have been going on for 12 days now. In addition to just getting the army out to help in the search and rescue, the army set up 3 field hospitals in very isolated areas in the mountains, mainly in the province of El Haouz, which is the worst hit region. And those have been used very well by the populations. In addition to those initial emergency relief, the things that needed to be done immediately, the king has also ordered financial contributions really much quite across the board. He created a special account number 126 with the Bank of Bank al-Maghrib, which is Morocco's central bank. And that is a fund that is in the account of the treasury that people can contribute to, whether they're inside Morocco or outside Morocco. That money is destined to go specifically for earthquake relief. In addition to that, he's also ordered that all civil servants at whatever level will be required to contribute some of their pay into the disaster relief effort. So all lower level civil servants will have a day's pay reduced from their wage over each of the next 3 months. And even at the minister level, there will be contributions much more significant from those high-level officials. In addition to that, we've seen the king has ordered the rehousing of displaced people who lost their houses in the quake. And right now, as of the latest numbers I'm aware of, there are 50,000 homes that are known to be damaged in the High Atlas Mountains. But I expect that when all is said and done and all of the assessments are completed, there will be a lot more. But the state will provide the owners of those houses 140,000 dirhams or about $14,000 each for a reconstruction of their demolished homes and about 80,000 dirhams for partly damaged homes to help fix them up.
Did the Moroccan government establish a plan to deal with the orphans who lost their parents in the earthquake?
The king is also focused on vulnerable populations and declared a few days ago that all children who have lost their parents, all orphans who lost their parents in the earthquake, will become wards of the state. And that confers some benefits on them in terms of education and healthcare and support until they finish their studies, and also a priority in getting civil service jobs. But one of the things also we're worried about is trafficking. So he's prohibited the publishing of photographs of children alone in the rubble to try and prevent that.
Most earthquake experts say the aftermath of a huge destruction like what happened in Morocco would need long-term plans extending over several years to rebuild what was destroyed. Is Morocco planning ahead?
Today was the third of three working sessions that the Royal Palace has hosted to do with reconstruction and general upgrading for the regions in the earthquake. And there has been announced a quite ambitious program designed to provide a coherent and rapid and proactive approach. It has an overall budget of 120 billion dirhams over a five-year period, and it will cover the six provinces that were majorly affected. That's Marrakesh here, El Haouz, Taroudant, Chichaoua, Azilal, and Ouarzazate. And probably a population of about 4.2 million people is involved in that. So they're focused right now on relocating disaster victims, rebuilding housing, rehabilitating the infrastructure. But the thing is that the geographical reach of the earthquake was really quite extraordinary. It was felt all across the country, including on the coast at Sawira and Im Souen, to the west of the epicenter in Iril, and then also far to the east, even past Ouarzazate, to some of the villages as far as Tinrir. And that's a span of more than 500 kilometers. It was even felt in Rabat, in the capital. So I'm afraid that they're still assessing, obviously. So I'm afraid that they're going to find that there's a lot more impact than they know of now.
That was Elizabeth Myers, an American political analyst living in Marrakesh, speaking with VOA's Mohamed Al-Shanawi. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhaib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, and our engineer, Nashwan Kali, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station Saturday.